Welcome to season 4 of the Gamers Change Lives podcast. Over the first 3 seasons of the Gamers Change Lives podcast, we've had the opportunity to speak with men and women around the world who are staking their claim in the esports industry. This season, the theme is going to be accelerating success and harnessing the power of esports incubators and accelerators. Tom and his team are going to highlight the crucial role that incubators and accelerators have on the esports industry and showcase the journeys of entrepreneurs who have leveraged these programs to propel their businesses forward. And now, here's your host, Tom Leonard.
I'm Tom Leonard. I'm the host of the Gamers Change Lives podcast, where we talk about how esports can create jobs anywhere in the world. Play games, create jobs, change lives. Now, in the past, in season 1, we talked about jobs. In season 2, we called it Follow the Money. We talked about investment. We talked about sponsorship. In season 3, we talked about business basics. And now in season 4, we're expanding a little bit. We call it Accelerating Esports Success. And we're talking to people around the world, telling the stories of how entrepreneurs, not just esports entrepreneurs, but all entrepreneurs, can tap into resources from accelerators, incubators, and other platforms to hone their business skills. Now, the goal of our conversation is to provide inspiration entrepreneurs to seek the tools, training, mentorship, the networking that's out there through these established platforms. Today, really, really happy to have Daniel Murky, who is speaking to us, and who has tremendous experience in Africa with Boxplay Ventures and even a podcast, Change Africa podcast, which we will talk about. Welcome, Daniel.
Yeah, thanks very much.
So where are you speaking to us from?
I'm in Accra, Ghana.
Great, great. We have all kinds of Ghana connections with this podcast, which one of the reasons that we're the success that we are because of the help that we've had there. So are you a gamer?
I'm not. I have very little gaming experience in my entire life.
Really? Why is that?
It's difficult to say, but I mean, I grew up, my first several years, I was between Guinea-Bissau and Turkey. And then when I was 7, I moved to Switzerland. And when I went to Switzerland, of course, there is like the first time I kind of got at least at the periphery in touch with gaming. And all my friends were into it. But for me, I was just, I would say my first 7 years, I was just brought up with different tools and I had different interests.
Got it. No, that's right, to put you on the spot there. It's just, and one of the things that we're talking about here in this season, so we're talking more about entrepreneurship than just esports. So yeah. The things that we're going to be talking about would apply to anyone, whether they're an esports entrepreneur. Because one of the things that we find with a lot of the people that we talk to is that esports entrepreneurs typically come from gaming. They're a gamer, and they're like, wow, I want to figure out how can I make a job out of this? How can I make a living out of this? So they come with gaming skills, but not business skills. So the more that we're talking about business skills, the better it is for our audience. So did you grow up in Switzerland?
Yeah, I grew up in Switzerland. So from age 7, I went through schooling in Switzerland and then until I came to Ghana, but I was already on my working life.
What languages do you speak?
I would say German and English. I'm supposed to speak French, but I've not practiced it enough.
Yeah, just curious. Yeah, you probably get more experience in Africa speaking French than anywhere else.
Yeah, probably. But I mean, in Switzerland, it's like when I went to school, we learned a second national language at age 12, and then I started learning English in school at 13. So that's why I'm saying I'm supposed to speak it pretty well, but I can write quite well and read quite well, but I've not really used it enough.
Yeah, speaking is completely different than reading and writing. So let's start out talking about Boxplay Ventures, because that fits in really well with what it is that we're talking about in this season. Can you describe a little bit about what Boxplay Ventures is?
Yeah, of course. I mean, in a nutshell, basically, Boxplay Ventures is a venture builder and also a startup and SME consultant. But what it mainly means is we are across the entire early stage financing value chain. So we support and co-create ventures with entrepreneurs, basically from idea stage 0, and take them basically towards time where they are really investment ready and are able to raise funding, let's say at a Series A. So we try to cover that whole value chain. And sometimes we describe ourselves as a corporate co-founder. And what we mean with that, we do a lot of the boring things that some of the entrepreneurs who are very creative are not good with. So that could be accounting, that could be writing contracts, just defining workflows and all those kind of stuff. That is where we usually come in. And then, of course, we also align with in terms of strategy and provide strategic support.
Where are your customers usually from, your clients that you're working with? Are they from Africa or are they in other places as well?
I mean, we are very much focused on Africa. But then when we say we consult startups, oftentimes the reality is it's either SMEs or, for instance, people from the diaspora or sometimes new entrants into the market, which could come from abroad.
Got it. So how did it start? One of the things that's always interesting here is when we're talking to people about how did things begin?
I mean, I guess when you ask the beginning question, sometimes it's always how far do you want to go back? But I think for me, I came to Ghana in 2007 and I did an internship in an investment bank. But our culture and the founder were very entrepreneurial. So I think there, at least, I got the bug for wanting to make an impact and wanting to make that impact in Ghana. And as I left the investment bank, I started to think about it more from a macro level and where could I fit in, where could I provide value? And that's, for me, was like more top down in terms from supporting entrepreneurs. And that was kind of the initial thinking about it. And then the other part was just generally being passionate about the business side of things and passionate about all kinds of businesses working together with entrepreneurs. And I think along that line, there were the insights on why maybe some businesses or startups in Ghana, in our region struggle and how we could support them. And that was kind of the initial pathway into Boxplay. And yeah, now sometimes we put that in maybe more sophisticated language, but very plainly, that's kind of it. And also seeing that we think that is where we can provide value and really co-create transformational companies together with entrepreneurs.
What is an investment bank? I always like to hear other people's descriptions, definitions. Could you talk about what an investment bank is, what it does? And also, what did you learn there that you could apply then to other ventures?
I mean, I'll talk a bit more from my personal experience. So at the time I joined the investment bank that I'm working with, which was an indigenous Ghanaian investment bank, we were very strong on corporate finance at that time. And what that means is we were basically helping companies, corporates, to access funding. So that could be through an IPO, through an initial public offering coming to the Ghana Stock Exchange. That could be through a private placement. That could be to all kinds of ways on how they raise funding. And that's one side of it. My initial first year where I was working there, I spent probably 9 months in that function. I also worked in brokerage department. So in brokerage, basically, we're buying and selling equities on the Ghana Stock Exchange for our clients. And the other part was asset management, where we had a fund, which is basically like now collected a collective investment of funds. And then we kind of make the buying decisions across different equities on the Ghana Stock Exchange and also some other instruments that like treasury bills and so on. So those were kind of the departments with which I worked in initially. And then what was very interesting for me when I came back, I went back to Switzerland in 2008, and then I came back as a senior investment analyst, worked there for 2 years. And aside of what's ongoing on the Ghana Stock Exchange, we were really working on private equity deals as well, and which was very interesting for me. So two of my main projects. One example was we created Africa World Airlines. So an airline together with Hainan Airlines, but basically we created the business plan, the project. The founder of the investment bank was the founder or co-founder of the airline. And it's just trying, what is interesting, I would say, is really at that intersection where it really becomes entrepreneurial as well, where it's not just purely the investment banking part of things. It's just, for me, how you can really conceptualize something from a desktop, starting putting things together and just aligning the pieces. But then also the entrepreneurial part is where eventually you probably want more than that. And also being the creator. So that is course, then that's maybe the intersection where it stopped for me as an investment banker. Another example is we worked with Accra Hearts of Oak, which is the oldest football club in Ghana. And basically, we did an initial public offering. So we didn't place the shares on the stock exchange, but it became a public company and got a new majority shareholder. So those were kind of the projects that I worked on. And ultimately, when you do these things, at the end of the day, it's just a lot of problem solving in the background, because there's always obstacles or things that might not have done perfectly in the past. And the job, to some extent, is to find a solution in reality and then the solution on paper as well, so that going forward, it becomes an investable company and also aligned with the strategy. So what I would say is, ultimately, it is, I mean, people talk about it sometimes in some, almost in an esoteric fashion, but it's closer to reality and what is happening on the ground. It's basically businesses that need to raise money, larger businesses that need to redefine their strategy. And that's kind of what we are doing. So a lot of repackaging, putting the business on the ground, the operational part, and then linking it to how can we get the finance.
That just must be a great education to work there as an analyst, to get to see so many different operations. I mean, you're talking about football, you're talking about airlines. It's like, you know, to be able to have a little bit of experience is would be really, really good. But in box play, who are the participants usually? Could you describe a typical participant?
Like a typical founder that we work with. Is that
right?
Yes. Let me paint a persona, kind of. One is like somebody with relatively lesser work experience. So for instance, it could be a graduate or somebody doing national service and having that entrepreneurial drive and wanting to build a business, but not having the necessary experience or business know-how. I think that could be a typical persona. And another persona is, for instance, a founder that is already working in the space, trying to kind of tackle a problem that we want to solve or a similar problem. And despite being committed, despite probably not earning any money and putting even personal funds into the business, something is blocked somewhere. And usually that could be maybe a mistake or a wrong business model that was initially set up. It could be the wrong team, again, be that lack of business know-how. So in that instance, it's also very attractive for us to come in with somebody like that and kind of being able to analyze, okay, what is missing? Maybe they are missing the right founding partner. Maybe there is somebody technical that needs to be on board. Maybe they don't know, have a go-to-market strategy, but we can kind of identify that and then put these pieces together. So really, basically entrepreneurs, founders that have some level of deficit somewhere, maybe on formal business know-how. Because I'm always saying, if you can do those things yourself, then probably you might not need to go to a venture builder. If genuinely you have that capacity, then maybe you go somewhere else that can also support you, but maybe support with something else. And you don't need to give out equity for somebody to come in with structure, strategy, and operational workflows.
I keep hearing you use the term venture builders. I promise it's not going to be a whole session of asking you to define things. But could you describe what venture builders are in from your perspective?
From my perspective, it's just like, as I said, I mentioned that word before. I interpret it as being a corporate co-founder. But maybe also when you look at, if you would look at an assembly line and the product that we create is ultimately a company. So you would ask yourself, what are the ingredients that you need to put together to create a company? So maybe in comparison to an individual founder, we look at it more from a very process-driven perspective and how we can do that repetitively. So of course, what are the ingredients? You need a founding team. You need some level of capital. And then you need to create a technological product. So we are looking at all these different aspects, try to break them down into repeatable processes as far as that is possible. It's not everything that you can do like that. But there's a lot of things like the workflows I described that you can at least learn from each other or save costs from one project to the other. So I would say we as venture builders, we're putting things together on that assembly line and kind of try to create a company as our product, including the structure, the governance, and so on and so forth.
How many companies have you created?
Now, with Boxplay, we are still very early doors. So if I would say how many companies, I would say three. But then to qualify this, there is different levels or different kind of companies that they are. There's some that are still at a stage where it's very dependent on me. So to some extent, that's not the product that I described. It's not a fully fledged product. If like we as founders or co-founders have to keep it alive. And then there is other ones that I did not that I would not qualify in the sense that maybe they don't have that ambition of scale. So those are smaller projects that we just did for different utility cases.
Now, it's just be really interesting to be able to deal with so many different companies out there. When it comes to recruiting founders, it's like from your perspective, how do you find founders? And then could you talk about if you're a founder out there, what's the best way to get the attention of organizations like yours? How is the matchup created in most cases?
Yeah. I mean, it's a very critical part. So it's a very important question. At the same time, it's also one that, to be honest, that I don't have a systemic, like a repeatable solution. So it can be very non-systemic. But I think the most important part from our side is just to try to be embedded within the ecosystem. Try to be where founders are. Try to be where there's people that want to make an impact. And I think for us in our ecosystem, something that we have not yet done or definitely not done sufficiently, but we want to do is to get closer to tertiary institutions. So already identify students with entrepreneurial talent, ambition at that stage, and then try to, from an ecosystem perspective, to grow them already so that we kind of have a pool of founders down the line. And then from the perspective of an entrepreneur, I always say it's like, ultimately, if you're an entrepreneur, what you need are insight. So my advice for entrepreneurs to find organizations is always try to chase the insights. Get the insights that you will require to make, like build that business, make that business successful. So it boils down to the same. If you are a founder that has maybe some deficiencies on business know-how, maybe you're more inclined to go closer towards a venture builder like us. Or maybe you can find it at some program for free. Great. You can find a mentor. But just go down that path of chasing the insights you require to solve the problem fulfill your ambition. And I think along the way, that's where the learnings are. And ultimately, if your ambition is big enough, at the stage where you set out to solve the problem, you do not have the answer. And no investor, no venture builder has all the answers. Otherwise, the venture builder or the investor would solve the problem by him or herself. So you kind of go for those insights. So if you, for instance, have a way to get in touch with Boxplay or with Daniel Merkey, and you talk to me, let's say on LinkedIn, ask the questions you need. See, does the way Daniel explained things, that has helped me to gain insights, is that valuable to me? And then you go from there. Maybe you don't want to start as a venture builder. Is there a potential to get me on as an advisor or as a mentor or have my number and ask a question once every 2 months? I think that's the best way to go for entrepreneurs. Really stay true to just gathering knowledge about the problem you want to see.
What's the value of mentorship, and how do organizations like yours create mentorship opportunities?
I mean, the value of mentorship, I think there's multiple aspects. Even when I talk, when I work within my firm, that's now not directly mentorship, but let's say I work with junior talent or employees of mine. There is employees that work within a field that I understand very well. So that's very different than me guiding somebody where I'm not the expert on the subject matter itself. So I think there is a level of general how to go about things, and then there's deep expertise. So I think that's a differentiation in terms of mentorship. So when you go for deep expertise, I think you have to look at people that have track record that can tell you actual things they have done, give you examples that you might not easily find on YouTube or in the books. Maybe I described how I worked on the airline project. There will not be that many information on how do you establish an airline in Ghana or in West Africa? That might be quite limited information to get insights. So if that's your space, you try and get somebody who has walked the path, at least to some extent. And then on the mentorship, on the other side, on how to go about things, it's an approach on how to think. So that's how I look at the mentorship part. So now when I'm mentoring you and youth, it falls within my area of expertise. Yes, I go with that. That if I don't have the expertise, I would look for people who have that and still kind of try to enable that connection. So that could be my advisory board member that I know is an expert in branding and marketing, and me having somebody more junior, more so, let them have conversations with them. And again, it's similar to the entrepreneur. It's like give them insights, give them more examples. And I mean, the need for mentorship can change over time. And I also personally feel sometimes you can even have a mentor that you don't know. I mean, you could go on YouTube and you just have an entrepreneur that kind of speaks your language, or you understand intuitively what he's referring to. So you can watch videos and just kind of learn from there. So I think it's always depends, but that is kind of how I'm looking at it.
When you're talking about founders, it's like one of the things I keep picturing is that you need founders who understand their deficiencies and are curious about filling them. And my guess is that that's not a big trait that a lot of founders would necessarily have. And maybe it's just my stereotype. Founders kind of think they can do it all. And so to me, it's like a really good founder could be someone that realizes they can't do it all, but they need help in doing things. Do you find that founders are usually out there seeking help?
Yes, I think good founders do. And I think good founders they need to be humble. Of course, that being humble can be expressed differently, because you have a lot of founders that are very out there in terms of their personality and everything. But ultimately, behind closed doors, do you really think you know it all? I think that's, if you generally think that, I think in most cases, that's a recipe for disaster. I guess there's always exceptions to rules. But I think the reason why I say humility is required is because you need to gain more and more and more insights to solve the problems. And I think that comes with an acknowledgement that there's a lot of things about even the problem that I solved that I've worked years on that I do not understand. Maybe the humility factor lacks in the sense of, am I able to learn and solve it? And maybe there is some level of irrational confidence that that founders display, and maybe also need in, like, even by what I said earlier, that by definition, if you have a big ambition, you do not know how to solve it. So for you to then still embark on that journey with open eyes, that takes a special or a specific type of person.
Yeah, I think founders that are curious are probably the best ones out there that always want to learn. Life in general, people are more interesting if they're curious about things and want to go out and do things. Your program, if someone joins your program, do you provide funding?
Okay, let me just clarify. In terms of program, we don't have a full venture building program that we are running reoccurringly at this stage. We are working towards that. But now, previously, the founders we invested, like we worked with, we made investments. So it was a combination of making investments and providing operational support. And in an ideal world, we would also quantify like our operational input. But at this stage, it was maybe more ad hoc than a fully fledged program is. So we just valued our cash contributions mainly as our input for the equity. But then, yeah, so I would say in terms of programs, we are developing a few things here, but nothing is set in stone, because the large part that we need to solve to have a reoccurring program is the funding. Because as a venture builder, I think that's one of the main problems you have, is that you are building companies, that's your product. And so that means even if successful, you're looking probably at exits between seven to 10 years. And how do you fund operational support for these ventures, reinvesting into new ventures over that period? So I think that's the crux that that we have to solve. So our initial investments for us was, to some extent, a proof of concept and the need to build track record. And now we are trying to turn that into a more sustainable system where we can eventually produce 2 to 3 companies annually.
Got it. Got it. When it comes to getting funding out there, and it's like, just like you're describing, it's like, it's the biggest thing, it's the biggest obstacle that most founders come up against. It's rare for a founder to have too much money. It's like, it's not, and that's probably not a good thing either. But in general, from your experience, where can founders find funding? Hmm. This is the loaded question that everyone wants a really quick and easy answer, but that does not exist.
Yeah, everybody wants that answer. Now, when you look at, there is the classical sources. I mean, first, everybody will tell you, first go with your own reserves, try and bootstrap, then you go to friends and family and like angel investors and all of it. But in our scenarios, like you look at an average Ghanaian, a lot of these things might not be available. I mean, bootstrapping to what extent? How much money do I have saved? Friends and family giving funds for a high risk venture might also be quite unlikely. So that is, as you're saying, that is a major challenge. But then again, you have to look on the ground and just see what is out there and kind of make use of it. So a peculiarity, for instance, but dominant in Ghana, we have a lot of grant funding because there's the development organizations, so on. And for instance, myself, I see that to some extent as an inhibitor for creativity for entrepreneurs. But on the other side, I also see it as a reality of our market. So you could be smart in positioning aspects of your business, especially non-core aspects of your business, to align with some of those grants and use them to finance those operations initially or proof of concept. So to make it more tangible, you could be, let's say, a delivery startup, and then you could ask yourself, is that you work with different motorbike riders? Is there a grant that would upskill them? Is there a grant that would support female empowerment so that you can do certain programs? Is there training programs that you could offer that align with your core business to some extent? And is there funding for some of those? And the other good thing about that is that once you are able to secure some of those, you become attached to that organization that gave you, let's say, that initial grant. And they usually would want you to be a success story. So they might open doors for you to go to the next, because it's a good thing for me to tell you that Daniel or Boxley gave you $5,000 and look at where the business is now. Obviously, it's not my $5,000 that did all of that work, but it's a good reference point for me. So likely that I might make a recommendation for that particular startup that went through my program and say, hey, Tom, these are some great guys. I think you should go, you should have a chat with them. Maybe you are a potential angel investor, or maybe you can open some doors for them. So that is one part. And then again, it's, of course, that's a hard thing to say to founders that, of course, funding, I know funding is critical, but sometimes you really have to look at the other side as well of how can you achieve things with lesser funds? And then you just try and leverage the little you have done. So it's a storytelling component to it where, yes, if I was able to achieve this with $2,000, Tom, look at what I did with $2,000. If you give me $20,000, think about what we can do and kind of embed that in a story form. So there is a lot of avenues that then again, for instance, in our system are almost out. I mean, the story of you getting a credit card and doing overdraft or loan in our high interest environment, those are not really feasible alternatives. So maybe dancing a bit around a straightforward answer, but what I have to tell you in this case is if you're really starting without that strong network, is you have to be creative and you have to tell your story.
Yeah, storytelling. So it's good. Now, what I like hearing you say is that someone that gives you a grant is interested in your success, and maybe they're not set up in a way to give you more money, but they may be able to open doors that
that other people may not have access to. I always tell people, because we kind of stumbled on the American embassy in most countries, every country around the world has funding for different types of projects, and it varies from country to country. So it's like I'm always telling people, it's like, hey, go check it out, because they may have funding for something, just the kind of examples that you were giving there. And the other thing is that if the American embassy gives you money, they want you to be a success, and they want to be able to say, just like you're saying, hey, we did this to help someone, and this is what they were able to do. So, the embassy or any kind of grant, anyone that gives away grants, they want to. So, if you can be a good storyteller and make them look like the hero, that's gonna benefit you in ways that you probably didn't think about. The other thing is, and maybe you would have an idea on this. It seems like a lot of programs out there also focus on what happens after the program. So someone goes through an accelerator, someone goes through an incubator. It's like, okay, what about this alumni network that you end up with afterwards? It seems like that is incredibly valuable out there to be able to have those connections down the road. Do you see this happening?
The network. I mean, definitely. I mean, the network is definitely valuable because it's also a pool of people that went through similar experiences are trying to chase the same thing. So there's a lot of insights and learning there. And I think depending on the program you go through, there can also be like a rubber stamp that in addition to the network that helps you. I mean, that sounds now similar to, let's say you're going to a certain school, for instance. Yes, you get the alumni network, but you also get some level of credentials that can then help you further. And what it definitely does is, in this day and age, it's like if you have access points to people, it's like you can reach out on LinkedIn and everything. It's like, so you really, it's not just that you say, oh, there is 100 alumni. It's like you can reach them even if there is not a direct contact, because once you have that kind of introduction level, that helps. And yeah, but then again, I mean, that depends on the program. And then in our context as well, it's sometimes getting into a foreign accelerator program or something that can be the ultimate rubber stamp, and it can even help you with increased valuations going forward. But, you know, sometimes it's like going back to the storytelling part, it's like you going for a job interview. Two people have the same experience, but it's again, how do you leverage that? How do you even tell the story of that? I went to this accelerator, I got this insight, I can do this A, B, C, D, versus someone else is not able to talk about it. So it's like the same with the alumni network. It's like, how do you activate it? And how are you also valuable to other alumni? Because usually I think it's an exchange thing to some extent. If people realize that you add value and you are helpful, usually at large, people want to help you too. So I think it's better probably to look at it from a long-term perspective and just also, how can you contribute value? And I think it will come back from those networks.
Do you find in the places that you work in that government and universities are maybe more supportive directly of entrepreneurs? Here in the U.S., we don't have, the U.S. government doesn't give you necessarily, I mean, there may be someone somewhere that you can find some grants, but that'd be relatively uncommon. And universities are playing a bigger role in developing entrepreneurship. Do you find that governments governments and universities where you are support entrepreneurship more directly?
I would say it's probably something that is now evolving. And then, of course, I mean, there is examples of universities. For instance, in just to name one, in Ghana, probably I think Ashesi has done a good job to create entrepreneurs. And for instance, I think it was just today that I saw again that they are getting, and they as university are getting like, or part of their venture creation are for entrepreneurs to support students, is getting 1.2 million to build entrepreneurs in, I think, the climate space. So I think it's something that is increasing. And also what also needs to change maybe is the profile or the picture of what an entrepreneur is, and it being something that is a first choice for people. Because I think in our markets, we have like it can be very challenging for graduates to get a job. So you might end up with graduates that were not able to obtain a job that then want to position themselves as entrepreneurs. So that's which mostly I would say is a problem. But then how can we, or even in like universities, accelerators, all of them, how can we paint the picture of the opportunity of entrepreneurship, how necessary it is, and do that early enough to really attract talented people with entrepreneurial talents to go down that path early enough?
Yeah, yeah. It works differently in different places, for sure. One of the things I want to talk about, I don't want to run out of time here, it's like one of the things I heard on your LinkedIn profile, enabling African entrepreneurs to create solutions to Africa's most challenging problems. Could you talk a little bit, because you have a unique experience there of being in Switzerland, I mean, and being familiar, maybe more familiar than some, with how business is done in Europe. Can you describe what some of the Africa's most challenging problems are?
Yeah. I mean, what I'm most challenging, and I have to say most challenging and common. So what I point at with the common is we are really talking about problems that affect the masses. And these are somewhat, maybe in developed country, basic stuffs like transportation. How do you get to work? So that could be access to water. That could be access to a toilet. So in many cases, these problems are really access problems across the population. And what it also is that then when you say across the population, then that means you go into more informal markets too. And I think in to solve those problems, you need an understanding of those informal markets, a deep understanding. So you cannot just build or take business models from somewhere else and drop them here and think it would work. The business models you create need to align with the market behavior. You need to understand it and embed that in the product you build, in the business model.
Okay. If people don't listen to anything else in this whole podcast, that's one of the most important things. Right there.
Yeah. And then even from a box place perspective, one of the reasons why we think what we do is really critical is because ultimately, who are the people that understand those problems the best? It's the people that experience the problem. But then when you don't give those people access to education, for instance, how do you create the people that are coming to solve the problem? So it's quite a challenge. So that is the question, is where can we position ourselves to kind of broaden the pool of entrepreneurs? How can maybe some non-conventional entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs from non-conventional backgrounds still get the support to access funding? Because they might be the ones that understand these informal settings, the market dynamics, the social economic and the social components to it better. So, and I think that's the ultimate for African entrepreneurs. Because once we do that, we will create solutions that eventually are different to the solutions that we see out there. Once we produce that, opens up the scope of what is possible. Because once you come from a unique perspective, unique angle, you might all of a sudden also create solutions that are even adaptable now in reverse to other areas. So I guess, that's my long answer as to which problems. There's so many. It's like even healthcare. What do you do for people to access healthcare? It's not just to put the facility there. So it's an understanding and listening to the market. So that probably goes back to the curiosity that you mentioned earlier as well.
Yeah. I mean, you certainly would not want to wish more problems on anyone, but problems also lend themselves to opportunities to do something to help people that may not be available to everyone. Could you talk about the difference between female and male founders?
Yes. I mean, that's a Daniel answer. That's not a box play answer. So it's really, because that's really based on personal experience. And also when we spoke about the humility component to get insights, I think there is differences there between female founders and male founders. And so what I have experienced with female founders is often a higher degree of de-risking. So I'm not talking about not taking the risk. I'm taking to really think through it and go and see how can we mitigate risk beforehand. And also seeing probably a higher level of experimentation. I'm not talking about technology experimentation to see what's the feedback from the market versus, I guess there is a higher, there is often a higher degree of, you could, if you want to say positively, of confidence with the male. But of course, the confidence can turn if you are wrong and you are too confident. That's a problem. And then the other thing is there's sometimes maybe a higher level of entitlement with male founders, just because maybe they're more used to being in certain rooms. And again, that might now sound as if it is so negative, but sometimes again, if you pitch in front of an investor, it is that entitlement or that confidence or overconfidence that can secure you your investment. So I guess it's always two-sided, but then ultimately, I mean, you want founders that understand the value of building a meritocracy. And when you truly do that, I think you get diverse teams. I mean, if you're really willing to listen to different perspectives to try to hire the best people, you would probably want to end up with a diverse team. And if you do not end up with a diverse team, then maybe there is something somewhere that you are not considering. Maybe there are so many obstacles for, let's say, females, and you just measuring with one yardstick is not you picking the best people. So sometimes you have to take that into consideration. But I would say beyond male and female, of course, entrepreneurs are already a rare group. And you just need like a mix of those characteristics. And I think there is some that, yes, females are more, generally speaking, more aligned with, and some males are more. So usually a good mix is probably the best in an ideal world.
Yeah, I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but there is a difference. I mean, there is for all kinds of groups out there,
and all kinds of.
And I've always understood that there are probably more female entrepreneurs in Africa than maybe in other parts of the world.
Yes, but I mean, the problem, you also have to look at what's the definition of an entrepreneur. So when you speak to me and I'm talking about entrepreneurship, I'm dreaming of transformational entrepreneurs that can build enterprises that can scale across the continent and even beyond, and maybe employ 10,000 or even 100,000 people in the future. So that's very different than somebody being a sole proprietor or somebody doing a small restaurant and being happy with having 5 employees, which there's nothing wrong with that. But so when we, with those numbers, let me say in Ghana, you'll be hard pressed to find in Ghana somebody who has never done a business. So when I came to Ghana and I was working even in the investment bank, and we were working long hours, statutes, everybody is having a side business. Everybody is open to doing something entrepreneurial. But then, so that, for instance, that points at an entrepreneurial culture. But you also see that, you could also say the other way around. Nobody's willing, or few people are really willing to jump off and go all out for a business. So even with the nature of some of the businesses that these females have, it would be interesting to really look into what kind of businesses, what are the ambition of these businesses before you can really analyze what that means from an entrepreneurship business.
No, I like hearing you describe that difference between being a sole proprietor and an entrepreneur that is building a bigger business. One thing I also wanted to ask you about is your podcast. I mean, we're obviously interested in how podcasts work here. So the Change Africa podcast, can you talk about how did it start and what is it that you're trying to do there?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because at that stage, I was in Nigeria and I was looking for Ghanaian founders. So I started to think, how can I become more visible? And I was really not good at it. So initially, I started reaching out to people on LinkedIn. And then you arrange, you reach out, you have a few calls, and then you realize, oh, no alignment, but you have spent an hour or 30 minutes talking to the person, then the next. So the next step that I realized is, okay, probably it would be better to build some level of profile and persona so that I attract the people rather than me reaching out to individuals. So then I became more active on LinkedIn and maybe also other social media. And as part of that, I was like, okay, probably a podcast would be a good idea. And so I started putting down like a one pager and was trying to put a team together that would help me to create a podcast in Nigeria. But I kind of just didn't find the right fit. It didn't click. When I tell people my vision and what I want to do, just didn't align. And then in December 2021, I came to Ghana and I had an interaction with a founder in the ghost kitchen space. And just at the end of the call, I mentioned it. So I mentioned about a podcast and he tells me he has the perfect podcast. He has the perfect person. So he connects me to the founder of Change Africa podcast. So he had done a season already. I went to check. I saw it was a while back. So he did a first season and the next season didn't come out. He connected us. And basically we had we met at the Accra Mall and we had a 6-hour discussion and we walked away as 50-50 partners. And the reason was because our visions were already kind of aligned. When I presented him my one pager, he showed me what he had done. And it basically was for us really to showcase diverse, unique stories of African changemakers, giving them a platform. And so that was the initial premise. But the truth is that as we have been doing it, as I'm part of this, it's far more than that. Because I now started to actually understand what it means when you say new African narrative, and why it's important to create that narrative. And that's partially because I came from Switzerland. So I had my role models. I probably had this, but then you start to realize this is a different context. You need to create that. You need to give these people the platform. And also the learning and the insights that I gained from it is something that I did not think about, but it's fascinating how people can create their circumstances where they are really determined. And I think that's what you learn from these people, especially from people that operate within really, I would say, severe constraints and still become change makers. And you see that that their determination, those kind of role models that we showcase, that's the real value to doing the Change Africa podcast. And so that's kind of it.
That's one of the best descriptions that I've heard, because that's exactly how I see podcasting. I didn't wake up one day and say, oh, I want to be a podcaster, because everyone has a podcast, so I want a podcast. It's like, no, it's like, here's an opportunity for other people to tell their stories. It's like, I'm not an expert on all this stuff, but that's the idea. I don't have to be an expert. I just need to be an expert. And Reginald has been the hero on that, of finding people like you that have good stories to tell. And I just get to help tell them. And completely true about LinkedIn. It's like when you're on LinkedIn and you don't have a podcast and you approach them, it's like, oh, I want to set up a time to talk and all this. It's like, yeah, it's an awkward situation. But it's like, oh, I have a podcast. It's like, oh, okay. It opens doors that... And again, just like you're saying, yeah, I mean, we've had we're on the fourth season. We've had, 65 episodes, not huge out there. We don't have a huge audience, but we have a really good community of people that we've connected because of the podcast. So I completely agree with the way that you describe the benefits. Who are some of your, and you don't need to say they're your favorites. What are some of the best episodes that you've been a part of that you think of? When people say, what was your favorite episode? It's like, what are the kinds of things that come to mind?
Yeah, I mean, we had it.
It's like, which is your favorite kid?
No, I mean, I could name several depending on what I highlight. But I mean, I had this question before. One is an episode with a guy called Teddy Totimi. He's a Ghanaian neurosurgeon. And just fascinating in the sense of, again, how they use little resources and to just make it happen. And it's like, he's a neurosurgeon, but he writes a lot. So he's really reflective and he's able to kind of make the analogies. And for instance, in that one as well, I got like, he made a statement that for me was like kind of a light bulb moment, like a click, because he made that analogy of he's made the statement that it is immoral for us as society in Ghana to expect that neurosurgeons or doctors do have to return to Ghana to serve, kind of, because of course, that in order for him to become a neurosurgeon, he had to go out there and there was no support. So yes, he is one of, at that time, I think he was 30 neurosurgeons in the country, that is here in the country, sorry. And he says that demand is immoral. And then he made an analogy of a player being at Real Madrid and having to come and play at a substandard pitch here in Accra, let's say, and how that person might not even be able to perform or not sustain an injury because it's like such a different setting. And he really made those examples on the job. So I found that very fascinating. There is another one, which is a 2 hour plus, I think 2 hour, 20 minutes conversation with David Hundeen. So he's like a very well-known investigative journalist in Nigeria. And I mean, it's hard to describe because it was really 2 hours, 20 minutes, so condensed for somebody who had to share his story. Because it's like, basically, there was no discussion because it's an hour-long podcast. There was no consideration of stopping him because the way the conversation went, we were just like, let the guy talk. And I really feel, I read a comment today on LinkedIn about that particular podcast. And in the comment, the person kind of stated, a Nigerian stated that the Change Africa podcast really did a good job on journaling the thoughts and the insights of this journalist for prosperity. And I think that's another thing when you look at creating information that can live out there. So you might not know when who is listening to it and what influence it can have. But I think those were two examples. But we had many other great conversations, but I think they just stand out, one because of probably also their professions, because it's the only neurosurgeon we had, the only investigative journalist we had.
This is obviously an audio podcast, but you should see his face when he's talking about these things. He lights up when he's talking about it. It's like one of the things that we did, and again, there's a lot of different great moments, but when we had Kwesi Hayford from Ghana talking with his team going to Bali, it's just like turn over the mic, just let them go. It's just like, because they were just, it was great to hear their story.
Yeah, I mean, I know Kwesi, so definitely amazing and passionate person. I mean, he's not stopping.
Yes, all you do is just put him in front of the camera. I mean, with the guys that went, it's just like, it was a life-changing event for them. And for them to, it was great to hear their stories. So, hey, I really appreciate your time here. This has been really interesting. Where can people find you?
Where can people find me? That's an interesting question. If people want to connect with me, number one, I'm in Accra. So for all the Ghanaians, you can still, same way as anyone else. Ultimately, I mean, I'm on social media. I think my most active place is LinkedIn. I think that's, just because it's the medium that's maybe more of long writing format that I'm comfortable to share. And usually, I'm usually responsive. Let me not overpromise. I say usually. And I'm easy to catch in terms of passion. So if it's something entrepreneurial, if it's a question, if it's something that I can do, I'm usually reachable via LinkedIn. And otherwise, we have a contact form on Boxplay Ventures, which if you respond there you get a response. The response might not be from me, but it goes to either me, my co-founder, or our administrative person, and usually we would respond.
Great. We'll put some links in the show notes there.
Okay.
No, really appreciate your time here. This has been a good conversation. We'll probably be putting it out fairly quickly here, and we'll let you know about it. So again, this is Tom Leonard. This is the Gamers Change Lives podcast. Play games, create jobs, change lives. Go out there and engage with us on social media. Follow us on whatever platform you're using to listen to podcasts, but engage with us on social media. So we always appreciate hearing from our audience. So thanks again, Daniel.
Thanks very much. It was great to be on the podcast.
Great. Gamers Change Lives podcast. Play games, create jobs, change lives. Thanks for listening.
You've just heard the Gamers Change Lives podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment and leave a review. And if you haven't subscribed, do so right now so that you can stay up to date with episodes as soon as they're uploaded, and so you can hit the ground running on changing your esports adventure forever. You can also visit us at GamersChangeLivesPodcast.com. Play games, create jobs, change lives. Thanks for listening.